some papers, first to cover two of the latter books of the Pentateuch, the books of Numbers and the book of Deuteronomy. The book of Numbers and the book of Deuteronomy are more important than the time that I'm allowing to them, but because we have so many books to cover, we are having to condense the time that we can spend, and we spend a great deal of our time now on Genesis and Exodus in particular in this week. So as we come to the book of Numbers, you can note on your outline that I've divided the content of that book basically into two parts: the years of wandering and the end of the journey. Actually, the book of Numbers covers most of the time which is involved in the whole period of the Exodus. The book of Numbers really covers approximately 38 years. So that time-wise, this book is particularly important, although it gives us very little detail of the events in the wilderness through the vast majority of that time. So, looking now at the book of Numbers, we note the years of wandering covering approximately the first 20 chapters of the book. And the first thing that I would call your attention to is the census that is taken right at the beginning, the command in verse 2, "Take ye the sum of all the congregation of the children of Israel by their families, their fathers' houses, according to the number of the names." Now, particularly, every male 20 years old and upward was to be numbered. Of course, this is where the book of Numbers gets its name, from this census and another census that is also recorded in the latter part of the book. Now, if you note these chapters that deal with the census, it's mainly a tabulation. It goes tribe by tribe, beginning with Reuben. It tabulates the number in each of the tribes. We note, by way of interest, that Judah is by far the largest of the tribes in number. And then the total number is given to us in verse 46 and amounts to 603,550. And of course, that's all of the males who were 20 years old and upward. So when we come up with the figure 2.5 million, we're basing it basically on statistical tabulations of what the total population of the people would be based on that many men of that age and upward. Then after the census is taken itself, the camp is organized. In chapter 2, we have instructions about the organization of the camp. We note that it's to be organized with basically the tabernacle here is kind of central to the whole camp. And then if we take this as the north, we have Dan and two tribes that are with Dan. And over on the east, you have Judah and two tribes that are associated with Judah. In the south, you have Reuben and two tribes associated with Reuben. And then you have Ephraim on the west. And this is the marching order. This is the way the camp of Israel was to march. And so the second chapter goes into considerable detail on this. Then chapter 3 shows us that the census was not just merely to tabulate the number of people that there were, but that God had his purposes in the taking of these census. And so third chapter deals particularly with the redemption of the firstborn. He states that in verse 12, "I have taken the Levites from among the children of Israel instead of all of the firstborn that opened the womb among the children of Israel, and the Levites shall be mine. For all the firstborn are mine." Now, what God is saying here is that instead of taking and claiming for myself all of the firstborn of all the families of all the tribes of Israel. Instead, I will take as a substitute for that the whole tribe of Levi. All the Levites will represent the firstborn of Israel. You remember when we studied the book of Exodus that we noted then when God redeemed the firstborn of Israel at the Passover, when the firstborn of all Egypt were destroyed. At that time, God made a point of the fact that the firstborn of all Israel belonged to God. And so what we have here is God now claiming that to which he has a right. When all the firstborn of Egypt were spared, were destroyed, the firstborn of Israel were spared, and in a particular way then, God laid claim on them. But I think we should also make one further point, and that is that the firstborn themselves in reality represent the whole. In judging the firstborn of Egypt, God was really judging all of Egypt. And in saving the firstborn of Israel, God was in reality saving all of Israel. And so in claiming the Levites to represent the firstborn of Israel, in reality the Levites represent all of God's people. And they are the ones that shall render the full-time special service before God on behalf of all the people. So then, all of the Levites are now numbered as were the other tribes formerly. And they're numbered according to their families. And the three families of the Levites are specifically mentioned for us here in chapter 3, verse 17, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. And these three families number up the entire number, and in round figures it's given to us, first of all, in verse 39, a total of 22,000. All the males from a month old and upwards. Then we're given a more specific number down in 43, which is the number of the total firstborn of all of the Israelites. Verse 42 tells us that God took a tabulation of all of the firstborn in Israel, and that numbered 22,273 according to verse 43. And so there is a discrepancy between the number of Levites in round numbers 22,000 and the number of the firstborn of Israel, 22,273. So then we're told in verse 46 that for the 273 that are in excess of the number of Levites, you see, you don't have a Levite now to answer to every firstborn of Israel. And so God says in order to make up for that lack, then all of these 273 will have to be redeemed by paying a certain amount of money. And so they take 5 shekels for each one of them. And the money is given to Aaron and his sons. And it's to be called redemption money. And it's to be used by Aaron and his sons in their care of the sanctuary and whatever their needs may be. So you see, God is very careful. He's very careful to count all of the males that are 20 and over in all Israel. He's very careful to count all of the Levites who are a month old and older. He's very careful to count all of the firstborn males of the children of Israel from a month and upward. And then he's very careful to account for every single one of those which he has claimed for himself, namely the 22,273. A Levite for a firstborn. And when we run out of Levites, then money is to compensate for those that are in excess. This shows us something of the care of God and the concern that he has for every one of those whom he has claimed for himself. He will not overlook a one. Then chapter 4 tells us about the varied duties according to the families of the Levites. And so you see that this chapter begins in verse 2 telling about the duties of the family of Kohath. their particular duty in caring for the sanctuary, particularly the holy things in the sanctuary. Gershom, in verse 21 and 2, begins his duties and their particular responsibility in the curtains of the tabernacle and so forth. Merari and his duties in verse 29 following, they would care for the boards and the bars and other parts of the tabernacle. Now, when the tabernacle was to be moved, each of these families then had certain responsibilities for the care for a portion of the tabernacle or its furniture. And when they reached the place where God would have them stop, then they would stop and set it up. And only the Levites were to handle these things. Only they were to have the responsibility for the taking down, watching over, providing for, caring for, and erecting the tabernacle whenever and wherever it was necessary. Having given these commands in relationship to the Levites, in chapter 5 we have something, and following in these next chapters, something of a miscellany of various instructions and laws that pertain to the relationships that shall exist between God's people and one another and God's people and God. And verses in chapter 5 tell us about what is known as the test of adultery or the law of jealousy. And the case is this. If a man shall suspect his wife of having committed adultery, but he cannot prove it, then he can bring her before the priest, and she can be given what is called here a test of adultery. In verse 16 following, this test is described for us. The priest shall bring her near and set her before the Lord, and the priest will take holy water and some of the dust of the floor of the tabernacle. The woman shall be required to swear that she is innocent, and then she'll be required to drink of the water. Verse 24 tells us that when the priest makes her to drink of the water after she has sworn, then if she is defiled, according to verse 27, if she is guilty and has committed a trespass against her husband, the water that caused the curse shall enter her and be bitter, and her body shall swell and her thigh fall away, and the woman shall be a curse. And if she is not defiled, but is clean, she'll be free. In other words, these things will not happen to her. Now, this is the only example we have in Scripture of a rather common practice in the ancient East in that day. And that's what is known as the trial by ordeal. The trial by ordeal was used by the ancients in many different ways. They used to throw a man or a woman into the river to see whether or not the river would swallow them up sometimes, to see whether or not they were guilty of this or that sin. There were various ways in which the ancients had of trying to prove the innocence or guilt of a particular person upon whom they could not really bring any evidence of guilt, and yet there was reason to suspect that the person was guilty. The idea being that if the person were innocent, the god or gods, whoever they might be, would protect that one, and he or she would not drown or suffer harm. But if they were guilty, they would be swallowed up. And so if you threw somebody in the river and they drowned, obviously they were guilty. The fact that they might not know how to swim didn't seem to enter in. The fact that it appears here is rather strange to us. Many have made a lot of this fact and have said that it's obviously a holdover from the ancient world and its ancient laws. It is in the Scripture. We have to face the fact that it is. It was given here only for this one thing, the test of adultery, the question of faithfulness or unfaithfulness. And probably it was given at this particular time for these particular people, basically because, again, God has put such a high priority on the family. And any threat to the family is particularly endangering to the people of God. And therefore, this particular trial by ordeal is instituted. Now, I know of no case where it was tested. where it was actually put into practice. The fact that it at least is something instituted here would apparently indicate that at least for a time it was in use. But it remains something of a mystery to us, mainly because we do not see any evidence of its use, and so we can't know any more about it than what is actually given here. Now, chapter 6 deals with the law of the Nazarite, and this is in relationship somewhat to those laws of the vows that we noted at an earlier time. The law of the Nazarite, particularly here, is called a special vow, according to verse 2. And the Nazarite was one who would separate himself unto the Lord. For a particular period of time, he would be committed to a full-time commitment and service and devotion to God. And during that time, verse 3 tells us, he must be separated from wine and strong drink, even vinegar of wine, or even grapes, even fresh grapes. Nothing from the vine was to touch his lips. Furthermore, according to verse 5, no razor should come upon his head. And in verse 6, he is not to come near a dead body. Many special ordinances then for one who would commit himself for a particular time in a special way to serve God. The word used here is separated unto the Lord, which would seem to indicate that during that time it would be understood that this person would probably relinquish other normal duties and give himself full time in some way to service and devotion to God. Now, it did have a limitation. Verse 13 would indicate this. When the days of his separation are fulfilled, he shall be brought to the door of the tent of meeting. And it shows how then the days of separation are properly to be concluded. Then we have something here at the end of chapter 6, which is a beautiful benediction, and it is given here by God through Moses to Aaron with a command in verse 23, "On this wise ye shall bless the children of Israel and say unto them, The Lord bless thee and keep thee, the Lord make his face to shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee, the Lord lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace. So shall they put my name upon the children of Israel, and I will bless them." We would assume then that this benediction was used frequently. It is not oft repeated in Scripture, and yet it's so beautiful that many have memorized it and have used it. Many ministers use this as a benediction, which they use at the close of worship service. Following this, still in the preparations for the people to move into the land, we're still in the midst of the time of the people getting ready to leave Sinai. We have in chapter 7 offerings of the princes. Again, it's a rather tedious tabulation here. Each of the princes is named in his tribe and his offering, and specified here in the amounts of the offering in the early chapter of the 7, and then the record of the offering made by each one of them. Each prince then was to make a special offering. Each head of a tribe was to make a special offering to God, again apparently to indicate the subjection and responsibility of all of God's people, and these representatives of God's people again acting on behalf of all the people. Verse 89 shows us Moses as he functions as a mediator before God and God's people. "And when Moses went into the tent of meeting to speak with him, then he heard the voice speaking unto him from above the mercy seat that was upon the ark of the testimony, from between the two cherubim, and he spake unto him." So you see that Moses was privileged to to enter into the very holy of holies, which was granted only to the high priest. Though the high priest has already been ordained and is Aaron, nevertheless, Moses continues to have this right and privilege. He continues to function as the mediator par excellence in ancient Israel. Now chapter 8 and 9 relate for us the preparations for the departure of the people from Sinai. They've been there about a year now, and they're ready to move out. Chapter 8 is more or less a review of commands, a review of instructions, and the organization, and so forth. Then we're told in chapter 9, the first month of the second year, after the people have kept the Passover, then the people prepare to move out. Chapter 10 tells of the departure from Sinai. 10 through 12 record this event. We note, first of all, in chapter 10, verse 3, that the people were to be guided by a trumpet that would be blown. When they blow the trumpet, two silver trumpets were to be made according to verse 2. And when they blow the trumpet, all the congregation will gather at the door of the tent of meeting. If they blow one, only the princes gather. Also, it could be used to blow an alarm. It was to be used when they go to war. It was to be used to signal the people as they moved out. Then in verse 11, we're told that the second year, the second month, the 20th day, the cloud was taken up. You remember that the cloud of Shekinah glory, the glory of God that hovered over the tabernacle, was the indication of the presence of God. Now, when this cloud moved from over the tabernacle, it was a signal that it was time for God's people to move. The trumpets are blown, the people get ready to move out. The latter part of chapter 10 tells us that Moses invited Hobab, the son of his father-in-law, to go with them. And first he says, verse 30, "I will not go." And then Moses urges him further. And actually, we're not told here whether he went or not, but later on, the indication is that he and his family did go. Chapter 11 shows us, again, this marked characteristic of God's people. Here they are, they're just getting ready to move away from Sinai, and the people begin to murmur. Chapter 11 tells us the people were as murmurers. It's an interesting way it's put here. Murmurer is a participial form in the Hebrew language and would indicate a continuing practice on the part of the people. And this, of course, has already been noticed as a basic characteristic of the people. God judged them at this point by sending fire among them, and it devoured in the uttermost part of the camp. You'll notice how many times as we go through our survey of the Old Testament, the word or the term or the use of fire is used to represent judgment, the judgment of God's people. And here, as the people begin to move out, they, even before they move away from the site of Sinai, they're murmuring. Furthermore, we have mentioned in verses 4 following a mixed multitude. Now, we were already told, you may remember, in Exodus, the 12th chapter, that there was a mixed multitude, which apparently means some people had intermarried into Israel, perhaps from the Egyptians. And the mixed multitude were a people who sometimes drew the people away from devotion to God. It says here they lusted exceedingly. They complained. And the people murmured and said, "Who is going to give us any flesh to eat? We remember the fish we ate in Egypt for nothing." How could they forget? They were slaves there. They probably worked 18 hours a day, and they say they did it for nothing. "We remember the fish. We remember the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. But now our soul is dried away." Isn't it amazing how quickly they can forget the hardships that they knew there? And the present hardships seem to them far greater than what they had endured then. They complain about the manna. We don't have anything to eat but this manna. Verse 10, the Lord's anger again swells up. Moses himself pleads, why have you dealt this way with your servant? I haven't brought all these people into existence. I didn't conceive them all. Why should I have to care them like a father carries his sucking child? Now, God here at this time then ordains for him to appoint 70 men of the elders of Israel. Some try to say that this is the same thing that the father-in-law of Moses had asked him to do earlier. But likely this is something different. At least this particular instruction is given directly by God to Moses and apparently is to be distinct from the time when his father-in-law told him to organize the people better and to set up many judges. These are particularly called elders. And this is the first indication of that organization of elders which goes all the way through the Old and into the New Testament, and which undoubtedly was a forerunner of the office of elder we find in the churches today. That is, elders, men mature in the faith, who have more spiritual depth and insight, who can help in the carrying of the responsibility of the leadership of the people of God. No one man could do it, not even a man as great as Moses. And so the 70 were established. Now, this, of course, later on becomes identified with the Sanhedrin, and in the New Testament still functions as a means of ruling the people of God. An interesting little insight into something of the character and nature of Moses himself is shown to us in verse 26 following, where the report is that there are two of the men that had been designated who were going about prophesying. And this concerned Joshua. And he went to Moses and urged him to stop these men. He was afraid, apparently, that there would be competition and that somehow these men might call away some of the allegiance of the people from Moses. Moses' response, would that all the Lord's people were prophets and that the Lord would put his spirit upon them. We see something of this happen at Pentecost long after this, when God did pour out his spirit on all of his people. And in those days, his people did begin to prophesy and to preach the word and declare God's truth in a way that undoubtedly was beyond even the imagination of Moses at this point. But here the real point I would make is that you see the meekness of Moses. You see something of the character of the man. He was not jealous for the leadership. He knew God had appointed him leader. But he could rejoice that God would give other people ability and talent also. Then God delivered to them the meat that they had begged for. And the latter part of chapter 11 tells us of the quail that were blown in. And when they came in, they just multiplied on the ground. And the people rose up and they gathered and they ate. And while they were eating and their mouths were still full of the food, God brought a plague on the people, and many of them were killed. God here gave them what they asked for and then punished them because of their discontent with God and their lusting after that which God had not provided, because it would imply that they did not believe God was providing all of their needs. And God had been providing all of their needs. Chapter 12 of Numbers, still dealing here with the early process of the beginning of the move of the people from Sinai, shows us the record of Miriam and Aaron also challenging Moses' leadership. Maybe they got the idea from others, but at any rate, they began to question his authority. They complained because he was married to the Cushite woman. Now, this has caused some problem for some people who realize that he had already been recorded to have married a Midianite woman, and some have thought this was a second wife. But Scripture nowhere records that Moses had a second wife. And so the likelihood here is that the term Cushite here and Midianite earlier are equivalent terms. Habakkuk 3:7 seems to equate the two terms, and this may be a key to our understanding of why she's here called a Cushite. Now, they question more than just his marriage. That was a pretext. What they really are questioning is his a right to speak alone for God. Is the Lord only spoken with Moses? Well, as a matter of fact, it seems evident that only to Moses has he spoken. Apparently, there is jealousy here. Miriam and Aaron, the sister and brother of Moses, both of them older than Moses, feel that they have a right to as much attention as he has. Verse 3 briefly describes the meekness of the man Moses. He was meek above all the men on the face of the earth, which apparently would indicate that he said nothing when he was challenged by them. God moved in, however, and said enough. Verses 6 and 7 following are one of the greatest tributes to any man ever recorded in God's Word. If there be a prophet among you, I, the Lord, will make myself known unto him in a vision. I will speak with him in a dream. My servant Moses is not so. He is faithful in all my house. With him will I speak mouth to mouth, even manifestly, and not in dark speeches. And the form of the Lord shall he behold. Wherefore then were ye not afraid to speak against my servant, against Moses? Here God himself intervenes, pays high tribute to the man Moses. Not, of course, to the glory of Moses, though at this point it was to make clear that God would work through Moses. Now, in punishment for this abortive rebellion, Miriam is made a leper. Why Miriam and not Aaron? We don't know, except that, of course, Aaron was a priest, and if he had been plagued with leprosy, he would have been immediately disqualified from ever being a priest again. This is probably the reason why, in God's wisdom, he was not stricken with leprosy, but Miriam was. But both of them got the point. Aaron pleaded to Moses to do something, and Moses pled with God. And she was healed, but she had, nevertheless, to go through a certain period of cleansing. All of this, again, to stress the truth of God, that he will choose whom he will choose to be in whatever office he will choose them to be in. And as the New Testament over and over stresses to us, it's not for you and me to say, well, why have you made me this way, or why have you given me this gift or ability and someone else something else? Why can't I be like him? Why can't I do what he does? God has given each of us what he wants us to do. And if we fulfill that function, we please him. Chapter 13 through 14 tell us of the refusal of the people to go in once they had been brought up to the borders, the southern borders of the land of Canaan. You remember the story, how the spies were sent out, one from each tribe. And when the spies returned to make their report, after having spied out the whole land and seen the great fruits of the land, coming back saying it flows with milk and honey, verse 28 they say, but the people that dwell in the land are strong, the cities are fortified and great. Now this seems remarkable, really, when you consider the fact that just about 2 years before, they had seen God overthrow the entire Egyptian army in the Red Sea. They, in the meantime, had seen many miracles and many demonstrations of God's power. And yet, when they see these great cities and strong people, they refuse to go in. Only Caleb and Joshua plead with the people to go in. The whole congregation now joins in the chorus in chapter 14. All the congregation lifted up their voice and cried. The people wept that night, and Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron. Would that we had died in the land of Egypt. Now real rebellion. Let us make a captain and let us return to Egypt. Again, you see the intercession of Moses and Aaron. They fall on their faces pleading with the people. Joshua and Caleb mourn and weep and urge the people to go in. They say, the land is good. If the Lord delights in us, then He'll bring us in. Don't rebel, warning the people. But the people nearly stoned them, according to verse 10. Now God again shows His displeasure. How long will this people despise me? How long will they not believe me? You see, that was the problem. The people were not learning to believe in God, and that's the only basis upon which they could have a right relationship with God. They must learn to believe in God. And this, over and over, they refused to do. They would not trust God. He threatens to smite again, to wipe them all out, and to start over with Moses. And Moses pleads again for the sake of God's name. And God pardons. Verse 19 is particularly interesting in chapter 14. Pardon, he says, I pray thee, the iniquity of this people, according to the greatness of thy loving kindness, and according as thou hast forgiven this people from Egypt even until now. Moses is going back to that revelation we noted in Exodus 34. Says, you're that kind of God, so pardon. And then he says, even as you've done over and over. He knows God's done it over and over. Yet do it again, Lord. Now God's answer is categorical. I have pardoned. But there are certain consequences that must follow. And he lays them out here. All of these 20 and over who have participated in this rebellion will never see the promised land. What God is saying here is tantamount to saying, you have proven yourselves to be unfit to go in. You to whom I have given all these blessings, you have shown yourselves unworthy. So in verse 33 he says, for 40 years you're going to wander till every one of you is dropped dead in the wilderness. And when the 40 years are up and all of your carcasses are dead in the wilderness, your sons will go in, your children, but not you. Also, according to verse 36, all of those who had brought back the evil report, these spies, died that very time by a plague. Now the people see what happened, and now they change their minds. Their vacillating nature, they say, all right, well, we made a mistake, we'll go in. So the latter part of chapter 14 is the account of their determination. Now they're going in anyway. And God will not go with them, and so they're badly beaten. It's a sad picture. How could a people come up to this point? How could they come so close? How could they see so much of God's marvelous works and still refuse to go in? Well, I don't know. But when you can tell me why I can know that my neighbor needs Christ and still I don't go and witness to him, then maybe I can tell you why. Why is it when God does so many mighty things through us and in our lives, do we still nevertheless fail to go out and take this world that God has promised to deliver to us if we'll be faithful? Go and preach the gospel to every creature. Now, why is it we're not doing it? The point I'm trying to make here is it's easy for us to wag our heads about the Israelites and how stubborn they were and how rebellious. But the point of this is it was all written for our admonition. And the point of all of this is lost if we don't begin to examine our own lives in the light of what we see here. How much murmuring do we do? How much refusal to go in? Chapter 15 deals with various laws, and we won't take any time to go over these. They're mainly a repeating You'll see the law repeated many times. Many of the same laws are given, even sometimes word for word. This is not because we have a lot of different documents here that were pieced together by later editors, as some would seem to believe. But it is to show the importance of each detail of the law in the sight of God. God never tires of telling the people, "This is the way I want you to live." Chapter 16 and 17 record the rebellion of Korah. Not only were there rebellions within the family of Moses, but there were rebellions among the Levites and other leaders of the people. Korah and his friends led a rebellion among the Levites. They gathered together some 250 of the people and attempted to overthrow Moses and Aaron. They challenged their right to lead the people. Again, God shows whom he will favor. Moses solemnly pronounces in verse 29, "If these men die the common death of all men, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord makes a new thing and the ground opens and swallows them up, then you can understand that the Lord has sent me." Well, the ground immediately opened up and swallowed them. You would have expected that the people then would have had great respect for Moses, but they didn't. Chapter 16, verse 41 simply says, "But on the morrow, the congregation murmured against Moses and Aaron and said, 'You have killed the people of God.'" Now, how they could accuse Moses and Aaron when they certainly didn't open up the ground and swallow them is hard for us to understand. But here we have then a people who show a basically rebellious nature in their hearts. You can just see it here. Blaming God, blaming God's leaders, refusing to learn. You can see why God would not bring this kind of people into the land of Canaan. They just weren't fit to go in. Thousands of them died that day by a plague. Verse 49 records 14,700 in addition to those that died with Korah. Now, in order once and for all to establish the authority of Moses and Aaron, chapter 17 records the incident of the budding of the rod of Aaron. All the rods of all the leaders were put together and their names put on them. They were put in the tent, and in the morning they brought them out, and only the rod of Aaron budded. Not only did it bud, but it brought forth blossoms and even bore ripe almonds. This was simply a miraculous act on the part of God, once more to show that the authority lay with Moses and Aaron, and God was getting tired of the challenges. And so it was to be put up as a reminder to the people from that time on. Then certain Levitical laws in 18 and 19, which we will pass over. Chapter 20 records the death of Aaron and the death of Miriam. It also records one of the saddest things, one of the saddest events in the whole history of Israel's wanderings. Records the sin of Moses that excluded him from the right to enter into the promised land. Chapter 20, verse 10, "After the people once more have murmured and wanted water, striven with Moses." Verse 10, he says, "Hear now, ye rebels, shall we bring you forth water out of this rock?" Moses lifted up his hand and smote the rock with the rod twice, and water came forth. Now the Lord says, "Because ye believe not in me to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel, you will not bring in the assembly." One of the saddest things I know of in all of this whole account. Apparently what happened was that Moses just lost control of himself. He had been challenged in his leadership and authority, as we know now, several times in a row. We can understand. But his mistake apparently was when he used the word "we." "Shall we," speaking here of himself and Aaron, "shall we bring you forth water out of this rock?" In doing so, he took the glory away from God. In doing so, he did not glorify God. In doing so, he did not show his faith in God that he had in time past. It was momentary, it was a slip, but it disqualified Moses from bringing the people in. It really takes nothing away from the greatness of the man Moses. But it does show one thing. God demands that all of his people at all times, without any relaxation, be faithful to him and glorify him in all that they do. The rest of this chapter tells about some of the battles that they had, particularly the dealings with Edom. They didn't actually have a battle with Edom, but they tried to go through the land and were refused and had to go around. Chapter 21 records the beginning of the end of the journey for the people. The episode of the fiery serpents is recorded here for us. This again was an occasion of the people's rebellion and displeasure toward God. The people were greatly discouraged, and they spoke against God, we're told in verse 5, and the Lord sent fiery serpents, and they bit the people, and many died. The people truly confessed, apparently, in verse 7, we have sinned, and Moses prayed for them, and God said, make a fiery serpent and set it on a standard. And so the people were to look upon it, and if they looked, they would live. They would not die from the bite of the serpents. And as I pointed out in the case of Lot's wife, this word look doesn't mean just to casually glance at, but it means to look with expectation. Apparently then, in looking at that brazen serpent, they were looking at a symbol of God's victory over the serpent. And this has, of course, some relation, no doubt, with Genesis 3:15, the victory promised over the seed of the serpent. Jesus himself makes the lifting up of the brazen serpent a kind of a type of his own death. In John 3:14 and 15, he says, as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. From 21 to 25, we have the record of the conquest of the various lands of east of the Jordan. We're still on the eastern side of the Jordan. We're not in the mainland now of Canaan, but east of the Jordan River. The record of Moab and other nations that tried to block Israel. In the story of Moab in particular, we have the story of Balaam. Balak was the king of Moab, and he sent for the man Balaam to try to get him to come and curse Israel. He had heard about the power of Israel, and he wanted Balaam to come as a mighty prophet and curse these people so that they would not prosper. The story of Balaam is an interesting one. First of all, he says that he must consult with God. He won't go unless he has God's permission. God at first tells him to go. But the thing that apparently happened here, well, first of all, in verse 12, it says, thou shalt not go with them, thou shalt not curse the people. And then the second day he's urged to go. And then he does go. God consents to let him go, but God really didn't intend for him to go, as is shown in the incident that it happens. On his way with the servants of Balak to go to the land of Moab to curse Israel, an angel of God stands in the way. We're told of this in verse 27. Finally, the ass sees the angel and lays down. And Balaam is angry, and he beats the ass, and he tries to force her to move on. And the Lord opened the mouth of the ass so that the ass spoke. And then the Lord opened Balaam's eyes, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing there. He says, I have sinned. The Lord says, all right, nevertheless, go on with the men, but speak just what I tell you to speak. It turns out that when he gets there, what he speaks is not cursing, but blessing. God only blesses Israel through his lips. And one interesting blessing here in verse 10 of chapter 23, the conclusion of his first blessing of the people, he says, "Let me die the death of the righteous, and let my last end be like his." I think this is an interesting statement. He's talking about Israel, God's people. He says, "I want to die like they die, and let my end be like theirs." Now, it would seem then that there is certainly here a clear intimation of a belief in a life beyond death in this man. Else the words "die the death of the righteous" would mean little. He looks to something beyond death and shows a hope of immortality here, it would seem to me. We might ask the question, who was this man, Balaam? He lived in Mesopotamia, the area from which Abraham had come long before. There apparently remained in that part of the world a people who knew something about the true God over a long period of time. Even the Magi, which are mentioned in the New Testament, in Matthew, were apparently of the same stock. They apparently even knew something about the prophecy of Balaam. I say this on the basis of 24:17, where there we read, "There shall come forth a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel." Now, the only place that a star is mentioned in connection with the Christ is here. And the Magi were looking for a star and a sign of a star. Now, whether God had in some particular way revealed to them that they should see a star, or whether they were basing it on 24:17 of Numbers, this we don't know. Who these Magi were, we don't know. They could, of course, have come in contact with the Jews during the Babylonian captivity, some 500 or 600 years before the birth of Christ. But we have no prolonged history of those people, and so we can't know. But it is interesting to know that Balaam came from that part of the world, the Magi came from that part of the world, and both had some knowledge of God and God's purpose. But Balaam was never able to bring the curse on the people that Balak wanted, and therefore he was not able, by means of that curse, to collect the money that had been offered to him.